sweeping tiles of a building, raking shots down into the shadows of the street. Dower fired back, hastily, dragging his las rifle off his shoulder. Lillo and Nessa reached his position around the same time and joined his fire. They didn't hit either of the Infadi, but they drove them back off the roof, out of sight. Broken tiles from the section of roof they had bombarded slithered off and crashed down onto the flagstones. McFan reached their position, too. The crossfire was intense, but they were a good 20 meters closer to the census hall than McCall's fire team.
"This way,"
Dower said, making sure he signed the words as he did so. Nessa was an ex-hab worker turned guerrilla, and like a fair number of the Vergestite volunteers, she was profoundly deaf from enemy shelling at Vervenhive. Signed orders were a scratch company basic. She nodded she understood, her fine elfin features set in a determined frown, as she slid a fresh ammunition cell into the port of her sniper-pattern lasgun. Running stooped and low, the quartet left the main colonnade and ventured through the airy cool and shadows of a hypostyle hall. This temple, and the next which they crossed into via a small, columned passage, was empty. What decoration and ornament the faithful hadn't taken and hidden prior to the invasion had been plundered by the Infadi during their occupation. Lamp braziers were overturned, and puddles of loose ash dotted the ceramic tiles of the floor. Splintered wood from broken furniture and prayer mats was scattered around. Along one east-facing wall, in a pool of sunlight cast by the hypostyle's high windows, a row of buckets and piles of rags showed where local people had attempted to scrub the Infadi's heathen blasphemies off the temple walls. The four of them moved in pairs, providing bounding cover, two stationary and aiming, while the other two swept forward to the next contact point. The back of the second temple led into a subsidiary precinct that connected to the census hall. Here, the walls were faced in black grandeurite, but some Infadi hand had taken a sledgehammer to the ancient wall carvings. The Infadi had posted lookouts at the back of the census hall. McFan spotted them and brought the ghosts into cover as laser and solid shots cut into the arched doorway of the precinct and blew dusty holes in the ashlar. Nessa settled and aimed. She had a good angle, and two single shots brought down a couple of the enemy gunmen. Dower smiled. The vaunted Tanith snipers like Mad Larkin and Rilke would have to guard their reputations against some of the Vergestite girls. Dower and McVan ran forward through the archway, back into the bright sunlight, and tossed tube charges in through the rear doors of the census hall. A row of small glass windows overlooking the alley blew out simultaneously, and smoke and dust rolled back out of the doors. The four ghosts went in, knives fixed as bayonets, firing short bursts into the smoke. They came into the Infadi position from behind. The intense firefight began to split the airy interior of the census hall. Dower's strike immediately diluted the Infadi barrage from the front of the building, allowing the pinned forces in the colonnade ample chance to push in. Three fire teams of ghosts, including McColl's, circled in down the colonnade. By then, Gaunt had moved up to the front line amongst the stelae.
"McColl, the front's barricaded firmly, sir,"
the scout leader reported over the link.
"We've got their attention turned away from us. I think that's Dower's doing."
Gaunt crouched behind a stelae and waved a signal down the line of crouching ghosts ranged along the side of the colonnade. Trooper Brostin ran forward, the tanks of his flamer unit clanking.
"What kept you?" Gaunt asked. "Probably all the shooting,"
Brostin replied flippantly. The Colonel Commissar indicated the census hall facade.
"Wash it out, please."
Brostin, a big man with ursine shoulders and a ragged, bushy moustache, who always reeked of promethium, hefted the flamer around and thumbed the firing toggle. The tanks made a coughing gurgle and then retched a spear of liquid fire out at the census hall. The jet of flame arced downwards with yellow tongues and noxious black smoke curling off it like a mane. Fire drizzled and trickled across the boarded front of the hall. Painted panels suddenly scorched black and caught fire. Paint peeled and beaded in the heat. The tie beams over the door burst into flames. Brostin took a few steps forward and squirted flame directly in through some of the tight firing slits in the hall's defenses. Gaunt liked watching Brostin work. The burly trooper had an affinity with fire, an understanding of the way it ran and danced and leapt. He could make it work for him. He knew what would combust quickly and what slowly. what would burst in fierce incandescent flames, and what would smolder. He knew how to use wind and breeze to fan flames up into target dugouts. Rostin wasn't just hosing an enemy emplacement with flames here. He was artfully building an inferno. According to Sergeant Vahl, Brostin's skill with fire came from his background as a fire watcher in Tanith Magna. Gaunt could believe this. It wasn't what Trooper Larkin said, though. Larkin said Brostin was an ex-convict with a 10-year sentence for arson. The fire, almost white, coiled up the hall front and caught the roof. A significant section of the front wall blew out into the street as fire touched off something volatile, perhaps an Infadi satchel of grenades. Another section gutted and fell in. Three green-clad men came out of the hall door mouth, firing las weapons down the colonnade. The robes of one of the trio were burning. Ghost weapons opened up all around, and the three toppled. A couple of grenades flew from the burning hall and exploded in the middle of the street. Then two more Infadi tried to break out. McColl killed both within seconds of them appearing at the doorway. Now, under Gaunt's orders, the ghosts were firing into the burning facade. A Pardus Hydra platform clanked down the center of the colonnade, trailing a bunch of prayer kite tails that had snagged on its barrels and aerial mount, and rolled in beside Gaunt's position. Gaunt climbed up onto the plate behind the gunner and supervised as the NCO swung the four long snouts of the anti-aircraft autocannons down to horizontal.
"Target practice," Gaunt told him.
The gunner tipped a salute and then tore the front of the census hall into burning scraps with his unforgiving firepower. Inside, at the rear of the hall, Dower and his comrades were moving back the way they had come in. Thick, black smoke boiled out from the main body of the hall. Dower, choking, could smell promethium and knew a flamer had been put to good work. Now there was a hell of a noise out front. Heavy fire, and not something man-portable.
"Come on,"
he rasped, waving Nessa, Lillo, and McVan back. The four staggered through the smoke wash, coughing and spitting, half-blind. Dower prayed they hadn't lost their sense of direction. They were remarkably unscathed. McVan had a scratch across the back of his hand, and Lillo was cut along the forehead, but they'd hit the Infadi hard and lived to tell of it. More heavy firing from the colonnade side. A couple of murderously powerful shots, glowing traces, tore through a wall behind them and passed over their heads. The shots had passed right through the bulk of the census hall.
"Gak!" cried Lillo. "Was that a tank?"
Dower was about to reply when Nessa gave out a gasping cry and doubled over. He swung around, eyes stinging with the smoke, and saw five Infadi rushing them from the main hall area. Two were firing las rifles. Another's robes had all been burned off his seared body. Dower fired and felt the kiss of a las round pass his shoulder. Dower's gunfire blew two of the Infadi over onto their backs. Another charged McVan and was impaled on the Tanith's outthrust bayonet. Thrashing, fixed, the Infadi shot McVan through the face point-blank with his pistol. Both bodies toppled over in the smoke. Lillo was borne down by the other two, who, weaponless, clawed at him and ripped into his clothes and skin with dirty, hooked fingernails. One got his hands on Lillo's las rifle and was trying to pull it free, though the sling was hooked. Dower threw himself at the rebel and they went over, crashing back through the doorway and into the fire-swamped main hall. The heat took Dower's breath away. The Infadi was hitting and biting and clawing. They rolled through fire. The enemy had his hands around Dower's throat now. Dower thought about his knife, but remembered it was still attached to the bayonet lug of his las rifle, and that was lying out in the next room next to McVan's corpse. Dower rolled, allowing the frantic Infadi to get on top of him, and then bucked and reeled, kicking up with his legs, throwing the cultist head first over the top of him. The cultist bounced off a burning table as he landed, throwing up a cloud of sparks. He got up, muttering some obscene oath, a smoldering chair leg in his hands, ready to wield as a club. The roof came in. A 5-ton beam, rippling from end to end with a thick plumage of yellow and orange flame, crushed the Infadi into the ground. Dower scrambled up. His tunic was on fire. Little blue flames licked down the sleeve and the cuff, and around the seams of the pockets. He beat at himself, stumbling towards the door. He hadn't taken a breath in what seemed like 2 or 3 minutes. His lungs were full of searing heat. In the annex at the back of the census hall, Lillo was trying to drag Nessa out through the back portico. Tarry black smoke was gusting out of the rafters, and the air was almost unbearably toxic. Dower stumbled towards them, over the burning bodies of the Infadi. He helped Lillo manhandle Nessa's dead weight. She'd been shot in the stomach. It looked bad, but Dower was no medic. He had no idea how bad. A dull rumble echoed through the blazing hall as another roof section collapsed, and a gust of smoke, sparks, and superheated air bellowed out around them. As they staggered through the portico into the rear yard, Dower heard something fall from his tunic and clink on the ground behind him. The trinket. The old woman's trinket. They dragged Nessa clear across the yard, and Lillo collapsed by her side, coughing from the bottom of his lungs and trying to vox for a med team. Dower crossed back to the flaming portico, tearing off his smoldering tunic. The heat and flames had scorched the fabric and burst the seams. One of the pockets was hanging off by singed threads, and it was from there that the silver trinket had fallen. Dower saw it on the flagstones, lying just inside the portico. He hunkered down under the seething mass of black smoke that filled the upper half of the archway and roiled up into the windy blue sky. He reached for it and closed his fingers around the trinket. It was painfully hot from the blaze. Something bumped into him and knocked him to his knees. He turned to face an Infadi cultist, his flesh baked raw and bloody, who had come blindly out of the inferno. He reached out his blistered hands, clawing at Dower, and Dower snapped his las pistol from its holster and put two rounds through his heart. Then Dower fell over. Lillo ran across to him, but Dower couldn't hear what the trooper was shouting. He looked down. The engraved hilt of the ritual dagger was sticking out of his ribcage, and blood as dark and rich as berry juice was pumping out around it. The Infadi hadn't just bumped into him at all. Dower started to laugh, inanely, but blood filled his throat. He stared at the Infadi weapon until his vision became like a tunnel, and then faded out altogether. Chapter 3 Pater Sin. Fortune deliver you by the nine holy wounds. Ayatani blessing. His father turned from the workbench, put down a greasy spanner, and smiled at him as he wiped his oily hands on a rag. The machine shop smelled of cog oil, promethium, and cold metal. He held out the piping hot cup of caffeine, a cup so big his small hands clutched it like a chalice, and his father took it gratefully. It was dawn, and the autumn sun was gliding up over the stands of massive nalwood trees beyond the lane that led down from the river road to his father's machine shop. The men had arrived at dusk the previous night, eight raw-palmed men from the timber reserve 15 leagues downriver. They had a big order to meet for a cabinet maker in Tanith Magna, and their main wood saw had thrown its bearings. A real emergency. Could the best mechanic in Prize County help them out? The men from the reserve had brought the saw up on a flatbed wagon, and they helped his father roll it back into the workshop. His father had sent him to light all the lamps. It was going to be a late hour before work would be finished. He waited in the doorway of the shop as his father made a last few adjustments to the wood saw's big motor, and then screwed the grill cover back in place. Collected sawdust had spilled out of the recesses of the cover, and the room was suddenly perfumed with the pungent fragrance of nalwood. As he waited for his father to test the saw, he felt his heart beating fast. It had been the same as long as he could remember, the excitement of watching his father perform magic, of watching his father take dead lumps of metal and put them together and make them live. It was a magic he hoped he'd inherit one day, so that he could take over when his father had done with working, so that he'd be the machine smith. His heart was beating so fast now it hurt. His chest hurt. He clutched the doorframe to steady himself. His father threw the switch on the saw block, and the machine shrilled into life. Its rasping shriek rattled around the shop. The pain in his chest was quite real now. He gasped. It was all down one side, down the left, across his ribs. He tried to call out to his father, but his voice was too weak, and the noise of the running saw too loud. He was going to die, he realized. He was going to die there in the doorway of his father's machine shop in Prize County, with the smell of gnarlwood in his nose and the sound of a woodsaw in his ears, and a great big spike of impossible pain driving into his heart. Colm Kolbeck opened his eyes and added a good 35 years to his life. He wasn't a boy any more. He was an old soldier with a bad wound in a grim, grim situation. He'd been stripped to the waist, with the filthy remnants of his undershirt still looped about his shoulders. He'd lost a boot. Where the feth his equipment and Voxlink had gone was anybody's guess. Blood, scratches, and bruises covered his flesh. He tried to move, and pain felled him back. The left side of his ribcage was a mass of purple tissue swelling around a long laser burn.
"Don't move, Chief," a voice said.
Kolbeck looked around and saw Yale beside him. The young Tanith trooper was ash-white and sat with his back against a crumbling brick wall. He, too, had been stripped down to his breeches, and dried blood caked his shoulders. Kolbeck looked around. They were sprawled together in the old dead fireplace of a grand room that the war had brutally visited. The walls were shattered skins of plaster that showed traces of old decorations and painting, and the once elegant windows were boarded. Light stabbed in through slits between the planks. The last thing Kolbeck remembered was storming into the guild hall. This, as far as he could tell, wasn't the guild hall at all.
"Where are we? What ha—"
Yale shook his head gently and gripped Corbeck's arm tightly. Kolbeck shut up fast as he followed Yale's look and saw the Infadi. There were dozens of them, scurrying into the room through a doorway out of sight to his left. Some took up positions at the windows, weapons ready. Others moved in, carrying ammo crates and bundles of equipment. Four were manhandling a long and obviously heavy bench into the room. The feet of the bench scraped on the stone floor. The Infadi spoke to each other in dull, low voices. Now he began to remember. He remembered the four of them taking the main chamber of the guild hall. God Emperor, but they'd punished those cultist scum. Kolia had fought like a demon, Lair and Yale at his side. Kolbeck remembered pressing ahead with Yale, calling to Kolia to cover them, and then pain. A las shot from almost point-blank range from an Infadi playing dead in the rubble. Kolbeck pulled himself up beside Yale, wincing at the pain.
"Let me look," he whispered, and tried to see to the young man's injury.
Yale was shaking slightly, and Kolbeck noticed that one of the boy's pupils was more dilated than the other. He saw the back of Yale's head and froze. How was the boy still alive?
"Kolia? Lair? I think they got out. I didn't see,"
Yale whispered back. He was about to say something else, but he fell suddenly dumb as a sigh wafted through the room. Kolbeck felt it rather than heard it. The Infadi gunmen had gone quiet and were backing to the edges of the chamber beyond the fireplace, heads bowed. Something came into the room. Something, the shape, perhaps, of a large man, if a man can be clothed in a whisper. It was something like a large, upright patch of heat haze, fogging and distorting the air, humming like the low throb of a drowsy hornet's nest. Kolbeck stared at the shape. He could smell the way it blistered reality around itself, smell that cold, hard scent of the warp. The shape was simultaneously translucent and solid, vapor frail, but as hard as Imperator armor. The more Kolbeck looked, the more he saw in the haze. Tiny shapes, twinkling, seething, moving and humming like a billion insects. With another sigh, the refractor shield disengaged and dissolved, revealing a large figure wrapped in green silk robes. The compact generator pack for the body shield swung from a belt harness. It turned to face the two guard prisoners in the empty fireplace. Well over 2 meters, built of corded muscle, with skin, where it showed past the rich emerald silk, decorated with the filthy tattoos of the Infadi cult. Peter Sin smiled down at Colm Kolbeck.
"You know who I am."
"I can guess." Sin nodded, and his grin broadened. An image of the Emperor tortured and agonized was tattooed across his left cheek and forehead, with Sin's bloodshot left eye forming the screaming mouth. Sin's teeth were sharpened steel implants. He smelled of sweat and cinnamon and decay. He hunched down in front of Kolbeck. Kolbeck could feel Yale quaking with fear beside him.
we are alike, you and I.
I don't think so, said Korbek.
Oh, yes. You are a son of the Emperor, sworn to his service. I am Infardi, a pilgrim devoted to the cults of his saints. Saint Sabbat, bless her bones. I come here to do homage to her.
You come here to desecrate, you vile bastard. The steel grin remained, even as Sin lashed out and kicked Korbek in the ribs. He blacked out. When his mind swam back, he was crumpled in the center of the room with Infardi all around him. They were chanting and beating time on their legs or the stocks of their rifles. He couldn't see Yale. The pain in his ribs was overwhelming. Peter Sin reappeared. Behind him was the bench his minions had dragged in. It was a workbench, Korbek now saw. A stonecutter's bench with a big rock drill clamped to it. The drill whined. The noise had been in Korbek's dream. He had thought it was a wood saw.
9 holy wounds the saint suffered, Sin was saying. Let us celebrate them again, one by one.
His men threw Yale on the bench. The drill sang. There was nothing Korbek could do. To the north of its area, the old town rose steeply, clinging to the lower scarps of the Citadel Plateau. A main thoroughfare called, confusingly enough, Infardi Mile, curved up from the place of wells and the livestock markets and climbed through a more salubrious commercial neighborhood, the Stonecutter's Quarter. One glimpse of the temples, the stelae, the colonnades, any of the Doctrinopolis's triumphant architecture told a visitor how exalted the work of the Stonecutters and the great Masonic guilds was. The most massive work, the great sarsens and grandiorite blocks, were brought in by river or canal from the vast upland quarries. But in their workshop houses on the skirts of the Citadel Mount, the Stonecutters carved their intricate statuary, gargoyles, ceiling bosses, cross facings, and lintels. At the bottom end of Infardi Mile, the Tanith chief medic, Tolin Dorden, had set up a field aid post in a ceramic-tiled public washhouse. Some of the men had carried in buckets or helmets full of water from the fountain pools in the square to sluice the washrooms out. Dorden had personally taken a disinfectant rub to the worktops where the clothes had been scrubbed. There was a damp, stale scent to the place, undercut by the warm, linty aroma that drifted from the drying cupboards over the heating vents. He was just finishing sewing up a gash on Trooper Goot's thumb when a Vergastite ghost wandered in from the harsh sunlight in the square. The rattling thump of Pardus mortars shelling the citadel rolled in the distance. Out in the square, Dorden could see huddles of Tanith resting by the fountains. He sent Goots on his way.
"What's the trouble?"
he asked the newcomer, a broad-faced, heavy-jawed man in his 30s.
"It's me arm, Doc,"
he replied, his voice full of the Vergastite vowel sounds.
"Let me take a look. What's your name?"
"Trooper Tyne," the man replied, dragging up his sleeve.
The upper part of his left arm was a bloody, weeping mess, with infection setting in. Dorden reached for a swab to start cleaning.
"This is infected. You should have brought it to me before now. What is it? A shrapnel wound?"
Tyne shook his head, wincing at the touches of the alcohol-soaked swab.
"Not really."
Dorden cleaned a little more blood away and saw the dark green lines and the knife marks. Realizing what it was, he cleaned a little more.
"Didn't the Commissar issue a standing order about tattoos?"
"He said we could mark 'em if we knew how to do it."
"Which you clearly don't. There's a man in 11th Platoon, one of yours, what's his name, Trooper Ku. They say he does a good job."
"Ku is a gackhead. I couldn't afford him."
"So you did it yourself?"
"Hmm."
Dorden washed the wound as best he could and gave the trooper a shot. The Tanith were, to a man, tattooed. Mostly these were ritual or family marks. It was part of the culture. Dorden had one himself, but the only Vergastite volunteers with tattoos were gangers and slum-habbers wearing their allegiances and clan marks. Now almost all of them wanted a mark, an axe rake, a Tanith symbol, an imperial aquila. If you didn't have a mark, the sentiment went, you weren't no ghost. This was the 17th infected homemade mark Dorden had treated,
He'd have to speak to Gaunt. Someone was shouting out in the square. Trooper Goots ran back in. "Doc! Doc!" Outside, everyone was on their feet. A group of Tanith ghosts had appeared from the direction of the fighting down in the merchant market, carrying Trooper Lair on a makeshift stretcher. Gol Collier was running beside the prostrate man. There was shouting and confusion. Calmly, Dawdon pushed his way through the mob and got the stretcher down on the ground so he could look. "What happened?" he asked Collier, as he started to dress the las wound in Lair's thigh. The man was hurt, battered, covered in minor wounds and semi-conscious, but he wouldn't die.
"We lost the colonel," Collier said simply.
Dawdon stopped his work abruptly and looked up at the big Vergastite. The men all around went quiet.
"You what?"
"Corbeck took me and Yale and Lair in under the guild hall. We were doing pretty well, but there were too many. I got out with Lair here. But Colonel Corbeck and the lad, they got him. Alive. As we shot our way out of the hall, Lair saw the bastards dragging both of them away."
There was murmuring all around.
"I had to get Lair to an aid station. That's done. I'm going back for Corbeck now. Corbeck and Yale. I want volunteers."
"You'll never find them,"
said Trooper Domor, stunned and miserable.
"The bastards were taking them north, into the high part of the old town, towards the capital. They're holding positions up there. My guess is they're going to interrogate them. Means they'll be alive for a while yet."
Dawdon shook his head. He didn't agree with the brave Vergastite's assessment. But then he'd seen a great deal more of the way chaos worked.
"Volunteers! Come on!"
Collier snapped. Hands went up all around. Collier selected 8 men and turned.
"Wait,"
said Dawdon. He moved forward and checked the minor wounds on Collier's face and chest.
"He'll live.
Let's go."
"You're coming?"
Corbeck was pretty much beloved by all, but he and the old doctor had a special bond. Dawdon nodded. He turned to Trooper Raflan, the Vox operator.
"Signal the commissar. Tell him what we're doing and where we're going. Tell him to get a medic down here to man the aid post and an officer to supervise."
Dawdon gathered up a makeshift kit and hurried after the troopers, moving out of the square.
"You're behind schedule, Gaunt,"
said the clipped voice from the Vox speaker. The lips of Lord General Lugo's 3-dimensional holographic image moved out of sync with his utterance. Lugo was speaking via Vox Pictor from Imperial Base Command at Ansipar City, 640 kilometers southwest of the Doctrinopolis, and atmospherics were causing a communications lag.
"Noted, sir. But with respect, we're inside the Holy City 4 days ahead of your pre-assault strategy prediction."
Gaunt and the other officers present in the gloomy command tractor waited while the lag coped with the reply. Seated in harness restraints to the rear, astropaths mumbled and muttered. The hologram flickered and jumped, and then Lugo spoke again.
"Quite so. I have already applauded the work done by Colonel First's Pardus units in breaking you in."
"The Pardus have done excellent work,"
Gaunt agreed smoothly.
"But the Colonel himself will tell you that the Infardi put up little outer resistance. They didn't want to meet our armor head on. They fell back into the Doctrinopolis, where the density of the buildings would work to their advantage. It's going street by street with the infantry now, and by necessity it's slow."
2 days, the Vox crackled. "That was the estimate. Once you'd entered the walls of the Holy City, you said you'd need 2 days to retake and consolidate. Yet you're not even near the Citadel."
Gaunt sighed. He glanced around at his fellow officers. Major Cleopas, the squat, plump, aging second-in-command of the Pardus armor. Captain Herodas, the Pardus's infantry liaison officer, Major Zabo of the Brevian Centennials. None of them looked comfortable.
"We are shelling the Citadel with mortars,"
Zabo began, his hands in the patch pockets of his mustard-drab jacket. Herodas cut in.
"That's true. We're getting medium firepower close to the Citadel. The heavies will pull in once the infantry have cleared the streets. Commissar Gaunt's representation of the theatre is accurate. Getting into the city proved to be 4 days easier than you estimated. Getting through it is proving harder."
Gaunt shot the young Pardus captain an appreciative nod. A calm, united front was the only way to deal with a tactically obsessed top brasshole like Lugo. The holographic figure jerked and fizzled again. A phantom of green light and mist, Lord General Lugo stared out at them.
Let me tell you now that we are all but done here at Ansipar. The city is burning and the shrines are ours. My troops are rounding up the enemy stragglers for execution as we speak. Furthermore, Colonel Cerno reports his forces are within a day of taking Hylophan. Colonel Paquin raised the Aquila above the royal palace at Hetchapsulis yesterday. Only the Doctrinopolis remains in enemy hands. I gave you the job of taking it because of your reputation, Gaunt. Was I wrong?
It will be taken, Lord General. Your faith was not misplaced.
A lag pause.
When?
I hope to begin full assault on the capital by sundown. I will advise you of our progress.
I see. Very well. The Emperor protects.
The four officers repeated the abjuration in a mumbled chorus as the hologram fizzled out.
Damn him, Gaunt murmured.
He's there to be damned,
Major Cleopas agreed. He pulled down one of the metal-frame slouch seats from the wall of the tractor hull, sat his rotund bulk down, and scratched at the scar tissue around the augmetic implant that served as his left eye. Herodas went to fetch them all caffeine from the stove rack by the rear hatch. Gaunt took off his peaked and braided cap, set it on the edge of the chart display, and tossed his leather gloves into it. He knew well what Cleopas meant. Lugo was new blood, one of the new minted generals War Master Makaroth had brought with him when he superseded Slado and took command of the Sabbat World's Crusade almost 6 sidereal years before. Some, like the great Uriens, had proved themselves just as able as the Slado favorites they replaced. Others had proved only that they were book-learned tacticians with years of campaign in the war libraries of Terra, and none at the front line. Lord General Lugo was desperate to prove himself, Gaunt knew. He'd botched command of his first theater, Ossilia 9, turning a sure thing into a 20-month debacle, and there were rumors that an inquiry was pending following his lightning raids on the hives of Karkariad. He needed a win, and a victor's medal on his chest, and he needed them quickly before Makaroth decided he was dead weight. The liberation of Hagia was to have been given to Lord Militant General Bulladin, which was why Gaunt had gladly approved his ghosts for the action. But at the last minute, presumably after much petitioning behind the scenes by Lugo's faithful, Makaroth had replaced Bulladin and put Lugo in charge. Hagia was meant to be an easy win, and Lugo wanted it.
"What do we do?"
asked Sabo, as he took a cup from Herodas.
"We'll do as we're told," Gaunt replied. "We take the citadel. I'll pull my men back out of Old Town, and the Pardus can shell it to pieces. Clear us a path. Then we'll storm the citadel."
"That's not how you want it to go, is it?"
asked Cleopas.
"There are still civilians in that district."
"There may be," Gaunt conceded. "But you heard the Lord General. He wants the Doctrinopolis taken in the next few days, and he'll make us scapegoats for any delay. War is war, gentlemen."
"I'll make arrangements,"
said Cleopas, grimly.
"Pardus armor will be rolling through Old Town before the afternoon is old."
There was a metallic rap at the outer hatch. A Tanith trooper on duty opened it and spoke to the figure outside as cool daylight streamed into the dim tactical chamber.
"Sir,"
the trooper called to Gaunt. Gaunt walked to the hatch and climbed down out of the massive armored mobile command center. The tractor, a barn-sized hull of armored metal on 4 massive track sections, had been parked in a narrow street beside the basilica where the city's refugees were now being housed. Gaunt could see rivers of them still issuing from the Old Town district, pouring into the massive building under the supervision of ghost troopers. Milo was waiting for him, accompanied by a local girl in cream robes and a quartet of old, distinguished men in long gowns of austere blue silk.
"You asked for me,"
Gaunt said to Milo. The young Tanith nodded.
"This is Ayatani Kailosh, Ayatani Gugai, Ayatani Hilias, and Ayatani Winid," he said, indicating the men.
"Ayatani?"
Gaunt asked.
"Local priests, sir. Devotees of the saint. You asked me to find out about—"
"I remember now. Thank you, Milo. Gentlemen, my trooper here has undoubtedly explained the sad news I bear. For the loss of Infarim Infardus, you have my commiserations."
"They are accepted with thanks, warrior,"
Ayatani Kailosh replied. He was a tall man, bald save for a silver goatee. His eyes were immeasurably weary.
"I am Colonel Commissar Ibran Gaunt, commander of the Tanith First, and overall commander of the action here at the Doctrinopolis. It is my wish that your High King,
so miserably murdered by the arch-enemy, should receive every honour that is due to him.
The boy has explained as much, said Kailosh.
Gaunt saw how Milo winced at the word boy.
We appreciate your efforts and your respect for our customs.
Hegir is a holy world, Father. The honor of Saint Sabbat is one of the primary reasons for our crusade. To retake her home world is my chief concern. By honoring your customs, I do no more than honor the God Emperor of mankind himself.
The Emperor protects,
the four priests echoed in concert.
So, what must be done?
Our king must be led to rest in sanctified soil, said Gugai.
And what counts as sanctified?
There are a number of places. The shrine hold of the saint is the most holy, but here in the Doctrinopolis, the citadel is the high hallowed ground.
Gaunt listened to Kailosh's words and turned to look out past the jagged roofs of the old town towards the towering plateau of the inner citadel. It was swathed in smoke, the white afterfog of heavy mortar shelling wisping away into the windy blue air.
We have just drawn plans to retake the citadel, fathers. It is our imperative. As soon as the way is clear, I will allow you through to perform your rites and lay your gracious ruler to rest.
The Ayatani nodded as one. There, thought Gaunt.
It's decided for me. Hell take Lugo's wishes. We have a need to recapture the citadel now. Cleopas, Herodas, and Zabo had emerged from the command tractor now, and Gaunt waved them over. He signaled to his waiting Vox officer, too.
We go for the citadel, Gaunt told the officers. Get the armor ready. I want shelling to begin in an hour from now. Beltane?
The Tanith Vox officer stepped up.
Signal the Tanith units in the Old Town area to withdraw. The word is given. Armor assault begins in an hour.
Trooper Beltane nodded and hitched his Vox set around to his hip, coding in the orders for transmission.
That one's your leader?
Sanian asked Milo as they waited in the shadow of the command tractor.
That's him.
She studied Gaunt thoughtfully.
It is his way, she said.
What?
His way. It is his way, and it suits him.
Do you not have a way, Trooper Milo?
I don't know what you mean.
By way, the Asholi means destined path, boy,
said Ayatani Gugai, looming at Milo's left side. Sanian bowed her head in respect. Milo turned to the old priest. Gugai was by far the most ancient of the four priests Sanian had found for him. His skin was wizened and deeply scored with innumerable lines. His eyes were clouding and dim, and his body, beneath the blue silk robes, was twisted and hunched from a lifetime that had been both long and hard.
I'm sorry, Father. With respect, I still don't understand.
Gugai looked cross at Milo's reply. He glanced at the bowed Sanian.
Explain it to the off-worlder, Asholi.
Sanian looked up at Milo and the old priest. Milo was struck by the peerless clarity of her eyes.
We of Hegir believe that every man and woman born in the influence of the Emperor,
she began.
Fate preserve him. May the nine wounds mark his fortune,
intoned Gugai. Sanian bowed again.
We believe that everyone has a way, a destiny preordained for them, a path to follow. Some are born to be leaders, some to be kings, some to be cattlemen, some to be paupers.
I see, Milo said.
You don't at all,
Gugai said with contempt.
It is our belief, given to us by the saint herself, that everyone has a destiny. Sooner or later, God Emperor willing, that destiny will realize itself and our way become set. My way was to become a member of the Ayatani, Commander Gaunt's way, and it is clear, is to be a warrior and a leader of warriors.
That is why we assuredly study all disciplines and schools of learning, Sanian said, so that when our way becomes apparent to us, we are ready, no matter what it brings.
Milo began to understand.
So you have yet to find your way?
He asked Sanian.
Yes, I am surely yet.
Gugai sat his old bones down on an empty ammo box and sighed.
Saint Sabbat was a low-born daughter of a Chelon herdsman in the high pastures of what we now call the Sacred Hills. But she rose, you see, she rose despite her background, and led the citizens of the Imperium to conquest and redemption.
The best part of 6 years in the Sabbat World's Crusade had told Milo that much. Saint Sabbat had, 6,000 years before, come from poverty on this colony world to command imperial forces and achieve victory throughout the cluster, driving the forces of evil out. He had seen images of her, bare-headed and tonsured, dressed in imperator armor, decapitating the demons of filth with her luminous sword. Milo realized the girl and the old priest were staring at him.
"I have no idea of my way," he said quickly. "I'm a survivor, a musician, and a warrior, or that's what I hope to be."
Gugai stared some more, and then shook his head. It was the strangest thing.
"No, not a warrior. Not simply a warrior. Something else."
"What do you mean?"
asked Milo, disarmed.
"Your way is many years hence,"
Gugai began, then stopped abruptly.
"You'll find it, when the time comes."
The old priest rose stiffly and wandered away to rejoin his three brethren, talking together quietly in the stepped portico of the basilica.
"What the feth was that about?"
Milo barked, turning to the girl.
"Ayatani Gugai is one of the Doctrinopolis elders, a holy man,"
she exclaimed defensively.
"He's an old madman. What did he mean I wasn't a warrior? Was that some kind of prophecy?"
Sanian looked at Milo as if he'd just asked the dumbest question in the entire Imperium.
"Of course it was," she said.
Milo was about to reply when his earpiece squawked and combat traffic crackled into his link. He listened for a moment, and then his face went dark.
"Stay here,"
he told the girl student. He hurried towards Gaunt, who stood with the other Imperial officers at the rear steps of the command tractor. Sunlight barred down between the high roofs of the temple district and made pools on the otherwise dark street. Ratbirds, their plumage grey and dirty, fluttered between the eaves or roosted and gurgled in the gutters. As Milo strode towards Gaunt, he could see that the Tanith commander was listening to his own headset.
"You heard that, sir?"
Gaunt nodded.
"They've got Colonel Corbeck. Collier's leading a rescue party."
"I heard."
"So call off the withdrawal. Call off the armor."
"As you were, trooper."
"What?"
"I said, as you were."
"But—"
Milo began, and then shut up. He could see the dark, terrible look in Gaunt's face.
"Milo, if there was a chance of saving Corbeck, I'd hold up the entire Fething Crusade. But if he's been taken by the Infadi, he's already dead. The Lord General wants this place taken quickly. I can't suspend an attack in the slim hope of seeing Colm again. Collier and his team must pull out with the others. We'll take the citadel by nightfall."
There were many things Bryn Milo wanted to say. Most of them were about Colm Corbeck, but the look of Colonel Commissar Gaunt's face denied them all.
"Corbeck's dead. That's the way of war. Let's win this in his name."
"Signal him no,"
Collier drawled.
"Sir?"
Vox Officer Raflan queried.
"Signal him and no, Gak take you. We're not withdrawing."
Raflan sat down in a corner of the ruined old town dwelling they had secured. Trooper Domor and four others moved past to the cracked and bare windows and aimed their lasguns. The old doctor, Dorden, weighed down with his Medicaid kit and loose-fitting black smock, was last into the building.
"I can't, sir, with respect," said Raflan.
"The colonel signaled the priority order, Cold Falchion, verified. We are to withdraw from the old town now. Shelling is to commence in 46 minutes.
"No,"
Collier snapped. The men looked round from their positions. Dorden settled in beside Collier on the slope of plaster and rubble under the window.
"Gol, I don't like this any more than you. But Gaunt's made an order."
"You never break one."
"An order from Gaunt?
You're kidding." "Not even on Nacedon, when he ordered you to abandon that field hospital."
"Feth! Who's been talking?"
Collier paused for a moment.
"Corbeck told me,"
he said. Dorden looked down and ran a hand through his thinning grey hair.
"Corbeck, huh? Damn it.
If they start shelling, we'll be hit by our own guns, Trooper Weln said.
It's Korbeck,
Dorden said simply.
Don't signal,
said Collier, reaching forward and unplugging Raflin's headset.
Just don't signal, if it makes you feel better. We've got to do this. You just never got the order.
McVenna and Sergeant Haller called back that the street was clean. They were on the edge of the Stonecutter's district.
Well?
Dorden looked at Collier.
Come on,
he replied. 2 hours after the midday chimes had pealed from the dozen or more clock towers in the Universitariat district, to be echoed by the clocks of the Old Town and beyond, the Pardus armor was unleashed. Led by Colonel First aboard the legendary Shadow Sword super-heavy tank Castigatus, a storm shoal of 50 Lehman Russ Conquerors, 38 Thunderous siege tanks, and 10 Stygies pattern vanquishers slammed into the southern lip of the Old Town. Long-range bombardment from Basilisk units and Earthshaker platforms out in the marshes south of the city perimeter fell for 20 minutes until the tank squadrons were poised at the limits of the Old Town district. By then, firestorms were boiling through the street blocks, from the livestock market north to Hamad Palisade and all the way across to Infardi Mile. The tank groups plunged forward, their main weapons blasting as they went. Vanquishers and conquerors followed the street routes, churning up the mile like determined beetles under a rising pall of smoke and fire dust that quickly shrouded the entire city. The hefty siege tanks ploughed straight through terraced habitation blocks and ancient dwelling towers with their dozer blades, bricks and building stone and tiles cascading off them. The thump and roar of the tank guns quickly became a drumbeat heard by all of the citizens and soldiery in the Doctrinopolis. The ghosts had fallen back into the suburbs south of the Old Town, and the Brevians had withdrawn clear of the firefield to the northern quarter above the Universitariat. Vox officers reported to the tactical teams that Sergeant Collier's team had not been recorded. The fire splash of the tank wave rippled through the Old Town all the way up to the base of the citadel. 20,000 homes and businesses burned or were flattened by shelling. The chapel of Kyodrus Militant was blown apart. The public kitchens and the studios of the iconographers were blasted through and trampled under churning tracks. The Iatani Scolum and the subsidiaries of the Isholi were destroyed, and their brick litter toppled into the Holy River. The ancient stones of the Indahar Sholan Sabbat Bridge were hurled 150 meters into the air. The Pardus armor ploughed on, directed by Colonel First and Major Cleopas. They were one of the best armor units in this segmentum. Old Town, and everything and everyone in it, didn't stand a chance. Chapter 4. The Colonel at Bay.
Lay a fire within your soul, and another between your hands, and let both be your weapons, for one is faith, and the other is victory, and neither may ever be put out.
Saint Sabbat. Lessons. The room shook. The walls and floor jarred slightly. Dust dribbled from the rafters. Onion flasks full of water clinked against each other. No one seemed to notice at first, except Korbeck himself. He was sprawled on the floor, and he could feel the flagstones stirring under his palms and fingertips. He looked up, but none of the Infardi had felt it. They were too busy with Yale. The boy was dead now. For that much Korbeck was thankful, though it meant it would soon be his own turn on the bench. But the Infardi were still finishing their ritual butchery, adorning the corpse with shunned symbols while they muttered verses from polluted texts. The room shook again. The bottles clinked. More dust trickled down. Despite the gravity of his situation, perhaps even because of it, Colm Korbeck smiled. A shadow fell across him.
"Why do you smile?"
Peter Sin asked.
"Death's common,"
Korbeck replied, spitting a wad of bloody saliva into the floor dust.
"Do you welcome it?"
Sin's voice was low, almost breathless. Korbeck saw that Sin's metal teeth were so sharp they cut the inside of the bastard's own lips.
"I welcome death, all right," Korbeck said.
He sat up slightly.
"Takes me away from you, for one thing. But I'm smiling, 'cause it's not common for me."
The room shook again. Peter Sin felt it and looked around. His men stopped what they were doing. With curt words and gestures, Sin sent three of them hurrying from the room to investigate. Korbeck didn't need anyone to tell him what it was. He'd been close to enough mechanized assaults in his time to know the signs. The hard shocks of shells falling, the background vibration of heavy armor. The room shook yet again, and this time there was a triple peal of noise, loud enough to be clearly identified as explosions. The Infadi were gathering up their weapons. Sin stalked over to one man who had a light Vox unit and exchanged calls with other Infadi units. By then, the shaking and the sound of the explosions was a constant background noise. Sin looked over at Korbeck.
I expected this, sooner or later. You presume it's taken me by surprise, but in fact, it's precisely what I—
He paused, as if unwilling to give away secrets even to a half-dead old footslogger. Sin made several guttural noises. Korbeck decided they must be command words in the Infadi's private combat code, and the gunmen made ready to leave en masse. Four of them grabbed Korbeck and dragged him up with them. Pain flared through his torso, but he bit his lip. His captors pulled and shoved him along dirty hallways and across an open courtyard behind the main body of the Infadi gunmen. In the yard, the sunlight was harsh and painful to Korbeck, and the open air brought the sounds of the Imperial assault to him with greater clarity. The overlapping, meaty thump of explosions, the swooping air rush of shells, the clanking grind of tracks, the slithering collapses of masonry. Korbeck found himself almost hopping along, trying to favor the foot with the boot on it. The Infadi punched and jabbed him, cursing him. They wanted to move faster than he could go. Besides, keeping one hand on him meant they each had only one hand free to manage ammo satchels, las rifles, and their other accoutrements. They pressed on through the interior of a stonecutter's workshop, where everything was coated thumb deep in white stone dust, before emerging through a set of wooden shutters into a steep, cobbled street. Above, not more than 2 kilometers away, rose the citadel. It was the closest Korbeck had been to the building. Its bleached cliff edges, fringed in mauve mosses and feathery lichens, thrust up above the skirt of roofs and towers formed by Old Town and the eastern hill quarters of the Doctrinopolis, supporting the ashlar-dressed pillars and temples of the Holy City's royal precincts. The monumental buildings were flesh pink against the blue of the sky. Sin's men must have taken him and Yale a good way north through the Old Town. Looking the other way, the street swept down through the jumbled old dwellings and massy stone shops towards the river plain where the Old Town started. The sky that way was a whirling haze of black and grey smoke. Fire licked through the town's flanks. Korbeck could see series after series of shell strikes fan in ripples through the streets. Geysers of flame, smoke, earth, and masonry blew up into the air. His guards pulled at him again and forced him up the slope of the street. Most of the other Infadi had already disappeared into the surrounding buildings. The gunman jostled him off the street, through a cast-iron gate into a level yard where stones and tiles were stacked ready for use. To one side, under an awning, sat 3 flat-pan work barrows and some cutter's tools. To the other, a pair of heavy old-pattern servitors that had been deactivated. The men pushed Korbeck down on the barrows. Pater Sin reappeared with 8 other men, moving from an inner door across the yard, and words were exchanged. Korbeck waited. The barrows were covered in dusty sacking. The mason's tools were nearby, 4 big adzes, a worn mallet, some chisels, a diamond-bladed trowel. Even the smaller items were not small enough for him to conceal. A whistling scream shook the yard as a shell passed directly overhead. It detonated in the neighboring building and blew brick chips and smoke back over them with a bone-shaking roar. Korbeck pressed his head down into the sacking. He felt something under the sacking. Reached for it. A heavy weight, small, about the size of a child's fist or a ripe ploin, with a cord attached. A stonecutter's plumb line. A hard lead weight on the end of 4 meters of plaited silk string. Trying not to let them see, he tugged it out of the sacking on the barrow and wound it into his hand. Pater Sin barked some more orders to his men, and then engaged his body shield, effectively vanishing from view. Korbeck saw his hazy shape, crackling in the dust clouds kicked up from the near hit, leave the yard by the far side, accompanied by all but 3 of the men. They turned back to him, approaching. A salvo of tank shells fell on the street around with numbing force and noise. Luck alone had caused them to bracket the yard, or, Corbeck realized, he and his captors would have been pulped. As it was, all three Infardi were knocked over on their faces. Corbeck, who had a more experienced ear for shelling times and distances than the cultists, had braced himself at the first whistle of the incoming shells. He leapt up. One of the Infardi was already rising, groggily, las rifle swinging up to cover the prisoner. Corbeck spun the looped plumb line in his hand quickly, letting the lead soar free on the third turn. It smashed into the gunman's left cheek with a satisfying crack and sent him tumbling back to the floor. Corbeck now spun the line over his head at the full length of its cord. He had built up enough force by the time the second gunman jumped up that it wrapped four times around his throat and cinched tight. Choking, the cultist fell, trying to get the tough, tight cord off his throat. Corbeck grabbed his las rifle and managed to roll with it and fire off a pair of shots as the first Infardi got up again. He was firing as he rose, the dent of the plumb weight bruising his face. Corbeck's shots went through his chest and tossed him over onto his back. Clutching his captured weapon, Corbeck stood up. More shells fell close by. He put a shot through the head of the Infardi who was still trying to get the line off his neck. The third was face down, dead. The close blast had buried a piece of tile in his skull. The rolling thunder of the barrage was coming closer. There was no time to search the bodies for ammo or liberate a replacement boot. Corbeck figured if he headed up the old town hill, he could get around the side of the citadel plateau and perhaps stay alive. It was undoubtedly what the Infardi were doing. He went through the doors on the far side of the yard in the direction Sin had taken. He kept hopping as shards of debris dug into the sole of his unprotected foot. He passed down a tiled hallway where the force of the blasts had brought the windows and blinds in, then on into a bay area where iron scaffolding was stored near to a loading ramp. Between the beat of explosions, close and distant, he heard voices. Corbeck crouched and peered through the loading area. The outer doors, tall and old and wooden, had been levered open, and a pair of eight-wheeled cargo trucks had been backed in. Infardi, about a dozen of them, were loading sheet-wrapped objects and wooden crates into the rear of the vehicles. There was no sign of Peter Sin. Corbeck checked the power load of his appropriated weapon. Over three-quarters yield. Enough to make them sit up and take notice, at least. The burning streets were alive. Humans, locals, fleeing from their devastated homes and hiding places with bundles of possessions, driving thin, scared livestock before them. And vermin, tides of vermin, pouring out of the inferno, sweeping down the hill streets of Old Town towards the river. Collier's team moved against the tide, chasing uphill at a run with rebreather masks buckled over their faces to shut out the searing smoke. They tried to head away from the blast front of the encroaching armor brigade while steering a path towards the Mason's district. Now and then, shells fell so close they were all thrown off their feet by the shockwaves. Torched dwellings collapsed across streets to block their route. In places, they waded through living streams of rodents, guard-issue boots crunching on squirming bodies. The eight ghosts sprinted across another street junction, wafer shreds of ash billowing around them, and took shelter in a leatherworker's shop. It had been gutted by shells, just an empty ruin. Dawdon pulled off his rebreather and started coughing. By his side, Trooper McVenna rolled onto his side and tried to pull a shard of hot glass shrapnel out of his thigh.
"Let me see to it,"
Dawdon coughed. He used his Medicaid kit tweezers to tug the sliver out and wash the deep cut with antiseptic from a spray bottle. Dawdon sat back, mopping his brow.
"Thanks, Doc," whispered McVenna. "You okay?"
Dawdon nodded the question away. He felt half-cooked, wilted, choked. He couldn't draw breath properly. The heat from the burning buildings all around was like an oven. By an exploded doorway in the far wall, Collier and Sergeant Haller looked out.
"It's clear that way,"
Collier muttered, pointing.
"For now,"
Haller conceded. He waved up troopers Garand and Coup and sent them dashing over to secure the premises next door. Dawdon noted that Haller, a Vagastite recruit himself and a veteran of the Vervan Primary Regiment, favored the troops he knew from his home world, Garand and Coup, both Vagastites. Haller was a cautious soul. Dawdon felt the sergeant sometimes had too much respect for the heroic Tanith to give them orders. The old medic eyed the other members of the squad. McVenna, Whelan, Domor, and Raflin, the other Tanith men. Hargion was the only other Vervenhiver. A small blonde man with a wispy moustache, Hargion cowered in the shelled-out corner of the premises. Dorden noted he could see a pecking order now. Collier's in charge, and he's a war hero, so no one argues. Haller's ex-hive military, and so's Garond. Ku, well, he's a law unto himself, an ex-ganger from the lowest hive levels, but no one doubts his mettle or his fighting smarts. Hargion, an ex-civilian. Dorden wasn't sure what Hargion's calling had been in pre-guard life. A tailor? A teacher? Whatever, he rated lowest of all. If they ever got out of this alive, Dorden knew he'd have to talk to Gaunt about evening up the prejudices that the new influx brought with them. Volcanically, shells splashed down across the end of the street. They were showered with debris.
"Let's move!"
Haller cried, and took off after Ku and Garond. Collier waited, waving Hargion and the Tanith past. Dorden reached the doorway and looked at Collier as he adjusted his rebreather mask.
"We really should go back,"
he began.
"Into that, Doctor?"
Collier asked, gesturing back at the firestorm that boiled up through Old Town after them.
"We're out of options, I'm afraid," Collier said. "Just to stay alive, we've got to keep ahead of the shells. So we might as well keep on and see if we can find Korbeck."
They ran through a wall of heat into the next ruin. Dorden saw the bare skin on his wrists and forearms was blistering in the crisping air. They darted into the next building. It was remarkably intact, and the air within mercifully cool. From the window, Dorden watched as shells slammed down close by. The building across the street seemed to shunt sideways, whole and complete, before disintegrating.
"Close, huh, Tanith?"
Dorden glanced round and met the eyes of Trooper Ku.
Trooper Ku.
Lyja Ku. Something of a legend already in the regiment. Just under 2 meters, slim, corded with muscle. Lean with a face like a bad lie. That's how Korbeck had described him. Ku had been a ganger in Vervenhive before the war. Some said he'd killed more men in gang fights than he had in battle. He was tattooed extensively and sold his ability with ink and needle to appreciative Vergastites. A long scar split his face top to bottom. Trooper Ku called everyone Tanith, like it was a scornful insult.
"Close enough for me,"
Dorden said. Ku flexed around and checked over his las rifle. His movements were feline and quick, Dorden thought. A cat. That's just what he is. A scarred and ragged tomcat. Even down to his chilly green eyes, Dorden had spent the last odd years in the company of exceptionally dangerous men. Rorn, that ruthless snake. Fagor, a soulless killer. But Ku, a casebook sociopath, if ever he'd seen one. The man had made a life of gang fights and blade wars long before the Crusade had come along to legitimize his talents. Just being close to Ku with his vivid tattoo gang marks and cold, lifeless eyes made Dorden uneasy.
"What's the matter, Doc? Got no stomach for it?"
Ku chuckled, sensing Dorden's unease.
"Better you stayed at your nice safe aid station, huh?"
"Absolutely,"
Dorden said, and moved across to a place between Raflin and Domor. Trooper Domor had lost his eyes on Menazoid Epsilon, and augmetic surgeons had rebuilt his face around a pair of military-gauge optic sensors. The Tanith men called him Shoggy, after the bug-eyed amphibian they decided he now resembled. Dorden knew Domor well and counted him a friend. He knew that Domor's implants could read heat and movement through stone walls and brick facades.
"You see much?"
"It's all empty ahead,"
Domor replied, the milled focus rings of his implants whirring as they moved around on automatic.
"Collier should put me up front, me and McVenna."
Dorden nodded. McVenna was one of the Tanith's elite scout troopers, trained by the infamous McColl himself. Between his senses and Domor's augmetic sight, they could be moving ahead with a great deal more confidence. Dorden decided to speak to Collier and Haller about it. He moved forward towards the bulky shape of the big miner and the lean figure of Haller, who still wore his spiked Vervan primary helmet as part of his battle dress. A shockwave threw him off his feet into the far wall. Plaster smashed and slid away as he hit it. For a fleeting, peaceful second, he saw his wife and his daughter, long gone with Tanith itself, and his son, Mikal, dead these last few months on Vergast, far away. Mikhail smiled, and detached himself from the embrace of his sister and mother. He stepped towards his father.
"Sabbat Mata," he said.
"What?"
Dorden replied. His mouth and nose were full of blood, and he couldn't talk clearly. The joy and pain of seeing his son was making him cry.
"What did you say?" "Sabbat Mata. Don't die, Dad."
"That's not your time."
"Mikhail, I..."
"Doc! Doc!" Dorden opened his eyes. Pain shuddered through his waking body. He couldn't see.
"Oh, Feth,"
he gurgled, blood filling his mouth. Rough hands yanked his mask off, and he heard liquid pattering on the rubble. He blinked. Whelan and Haller were bent over him, anxious looks on their faces.
"What?"
Dorden mumbled.
"Thought you were Feth and dead,"
Whelan cried. They helped him sit up. Dorden wiped his face and saw his hand came away bloody. He checked his face and realized his nose was streaming blood. The nosebleed had filled his mask and blinded his eye slits.
"Feth,"
he snarled, getting up. His head swam and he sat back.
"Who did we lose?"
he asked.
"No one,"
Haller said. Dorden looked around. The shell had taken out the west wall of the building, but all his comrades were intact. Collier, Coo, Garond, Raflan, McVenner, Hardion.
"Charmed lives,"
said Coo, with a chuckle. With the help of Weln and Haller, Dorden got to his feet. He felt like the spirit had been blasted out of him.
"You all right?"
Collier asked. Dorden spat clotted blood and wiped his face.
"Just dandy," he said. "If we're going, let's just go, right?"
Collier nodded and signaled the party to their feet. Firestorms were ripping down both sides of the street by them, and further shells were adding to the inferno. Behind the dwelling, they found that the shell had blown open a watercourse, gurgling below street level, in a brick defile. Collier and McVenner leapt down into it. The brackish water, perhaps an ancient tributary of the Holy River, surged around their boots. Dorden followed them down. It was cooler here, and the moving water seemed to wash away the thick smoke.
"Let's move along it,"
Collier suggested. No one argued. In a tight line, the seven ghosts tracked up the watercourse through the fires. They'd gone no more than 100 meters when Trooper Koo suddenly held up his hand. The crude tats of a skull and crossbones marked his knuckles.
"Hear that?"
he asked.
"Less fire."
Korbeck's shots tore through the loading bay. Two Infardi were slammed back off the side of one of the trucks. Another toppled, dropping the crate he had been carrying. They started firing back almost immediately, pulling handguns from their sashes or grabbing the las rifles leaning up against the wall. Glittering laser fire and whining hard rounds hammered into the stacked scaffolding around Korbeck. He didn't flinch. Kicking over a stack of scaffolding, he ran down the length of the bay's side wall, firing from the hip. Another Infardi clutched his throat, fell on his back, and slithered off the bed of one of the trucks. A bullet creased his tricep. A las round tore through the thigh pocket of his combat pants. He threw himself into cover behind an archway pillar. It